Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Richard Ovenden, and I have the immense privilege of being both Bodleian Librarian and Chair of the Board of Electors to the Lyell Readership and Bibliography. And it's under these dual auspices that I welcome you here to the Sir Vicks Blank Lecture Theatre in the Western Library of the Bodleian Libraries this evening. And before I go any further, I'd like to express my great thanks to my fellow electors for their diligence and hard work. It's such a pleasure to be on that committee with them. These lectures are being recorded for release on the library's podcast channel, ladies and gentlemen, and this first lecture is also being live streamed. So I have great pleasure in welcoming those of you watching in Chelmsford or Chile. Before I go any further, I would like to invite you all to join the electors, this year's reader, and myself for our traditional Biblio-libation in Blackwell Hall after the lecture. Sadly, those of you in Chile or Chelmsford will have to take care of this element yourselves. There is also a small display of books, including one annotated by Erasmus, and again, those of you in Chelmsford or Chile will have to find your own books annotated by Erasmus for this part of the evening. Before we move on to the specifics of this evening's lecture and our lecturer, allow me to explain a little of the background and history to the Lyell Lectures. James P.R. Lyell, there he is, looking down at us, was a lawyer and book collector who lived in Oxford and on his retirement in Abingdon. He not only collected books in a serious way, but also studied them closely, publishing his research on early book illustration in Spain in 1925. Over 100 of his best books, medieval manuscripts, were bequeathed to the Bodleian on his death in 1948, and the library subsequently purchased another 60 manuscripts and many early printed books from his executors. Tilly Dyer Mayer, then on the staff of the Bodleian, published a scholarly catalogue of the medieval manuscripts, then in Bodley, in 1971. In addition to this great generosity to the Bodleian, J.P.R. Lyell also left a bequest to establish a series of lectures in bibliography to be delivered by invitation by leading scholars working in the field. To this end, the university established a board of electors to review the state of scholarship and to invite the leading proponents to hold the readership. It is this body, one that I've chaired since 2013, that has invited the current reader to deliver this year's lectures. The Lyell Lectures have more than fulfilled the expectations of their benefactor. The lectures have made a substantial contribution to the field of bibliography in its broadest interpretation. A high proportion of the lectures have been published, and many of these have become heavily cited works of scholarship, and not a few are known internationally as groundbreaking in their field. The Lyell Lectures were first delivered in 1952-3 by Neil Kerr, reader in bibliography in the University of Oxford, and published by OUP in 1960 as English manuscripts in the century after the Norman Conquest. Since then, many distinguished readers have delivered lectures which have produced scholarship of an enduring quality. Walter Gregg in 1954-5 published his as Some Aspects and Problems of London Publishing between 1550 and 1650. Fredson Bower soon after gave his published as Bibliography and Textual Criticism. Jonathan Alexander published Medieval Illuminators and Their Methods of Work from in 1993 from his 1982-3 Lyells. Elizabeth Eisenstein delivered hers on Grub Street Abroad, Aspects of the French Cosmopolitan Press from the Age of Louis XIV to the French Revolution. David McKitterick's of 1999-2000 were given as set in print, The Fortunes of an Idea, circa 1450-1800, published as Print Manuscript and the Search for Order in 2003. In 2015, Tessa Weber gave the Lyells as Public Reading and its books, Monastic Ideals and Practice in England, and the most recent reader, Professor Susan Rankin, delivered hers with musical accompaniment on English liturgical books and musical notations 900-1150 last year. Our reader this year more than lives up to the standards of eminence set by the best of her predecessors. She has held a series of distinguished chairs at Harvard, including the Henry Charles Lea Professorship of History, and is currently the Carl H. Pforzheimer University Professor, a post closely associated with the Harvard University Library and the Domain of Knowledge. Anne Blair was educated at Harvard, the University of Cambridge, and at Princeton, where she was only the second graduate student of Tony Grafton. A dissertation at Princeton on Jean Bodin became the basis of her first book, published in 1996. She has followed this with an acclaimed series of publications which have established her as being in the front rank of scholars working on the place of knowledge in the early modern world. Her topics range from organisations of knowledge in the Cambridge Companion to Renaissance Philosophy to studies of note-taking in Renaissance Europe, most recently in the Intellectual History Review. She has published on disciplinary cultures and on archives, and her graduate dissertation, The Theatre of Nature, Jean Bodin and Renaissance Science, was brought out by Princeton University Press in 1997. She made a compelling case for the notion of information overload not being unique to our digital era in her superb monograph published by Yale in 2010, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. So good that it appears on many reading lists for history courses around the world, including the University of Manchester, a fact which prompted my elder daughter to run off with my copy when she was a student. I still haven't got it back. Most recently, she edited with Paul Duguid, Anya Sylvia Going, and Tony Grafton the major new reference work, Information Historical Companion, published by Princeton in 2021, to which she was also a contributor. Anne is also a celebrated teacher, for which she has been lauded as much as for her research. She has received the Everett Mendelssohn Excellence in Mentoring Award in 2014 and won the Harvard Phi Beta Kappa Teaching Prize for 2018. Four students for whom Blair was an advisor won the Hoopers Prize for Outstanding Senior Thesis, a prize that Anne herself won when a student at Harvard College. She was the recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship in 2002, was elected to the American Philosophical Society in 2009, and was awarded a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship in 2014. She currently serves on the board of the Journal of the History of Ideas. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Anne Blair for the first of her Lyell Lectures for 2023 on In the Scholar's Workshop, Amanuenses in Early Modern Europe.
Thank you, Richard, for that very generous introduction, and to all the lectors for their confidence in me. It's a really great pleasure and honor to be here. And I'm grateful to the team at the Bodleian and the Center for the History of the Book for their careful planning and friendly support, in particular Lucy Bailey, Georgia Binning, and Alexander Franklin. And warm thanks to everyone who's come today, in person or online, and I look forward to receiving feedback in person or by email. So my aim in these lectures is to contribute to bibliography and book history by focusing on some of the lesser known figures involved in making manuscripts and printed books in early modern Europe. I hope that studying amanuenses, more on that term in a sec, can help us learn more about three different areas. One, scholarly practices and working methods. What kinds of work did amanuenses do and with what impacts for them, for the scholars with whom they worked, and for the texts that resulted from that work? And although my basic point is that amanuenses were everywhere, a regular feature of scholarship for a very long time, there were also reasons to avoid amanuenses, which I'd like to mention here, for example, when working with ideas and texts that had to be kept strictly private for fear of prosecution, as Martin Mulso points out in his book Precaris Wissen, recently translated as Knowledge Lost. Two, attribution, blame, and credit. How does looking for clues about amanuenses change our perspective on the claims made in manuscripts and printed books about their origins? Art historians have long been attentive to this question and aware of the role that assistants played in the artist's workshop in carrying out certain parts of a painting, either with creative leeway or following precise instructions, and sometimes according to an explicit contract with the commissioner, which might call, for example, for the named artist to do the face and hands at the very least. So I'm interested in parallels then with text production. And thirdly, about the lives of the little people in intellectual history. Amanuenses are one category among many figures who played crucial roles in knowledge making, but have remained on the sidelines of formal attributions and acknowledgement, both at the time and since. A seminal article for this angle is Steve Chapin's 1989, The Invisible Technician, which points out that multiple people were needed to make, manage, and manipulate the instruments used in experiments at the Royal Society, but these people were routinely left out of accounts of those experiments. Since then, historians of science have done great work identifying many contributors to natural knowledge, including artisans, women, servants, or enslaved people, whose empirical and practical knowledge was included in natural histories. And then historians of cross-cultural encounters have likewise emphasized the crucial role of go-betweens, whether informal or professional, who variously served as interpreters, translators, agents, unofficial diplomats, local guides, or informants. And recent work in book history has also fleshed out the many roles performed inside the print shop, from the correctors to the gophers who delivered the printed sheets to them and might be the printer's daughter, as in the case of Plantin's daughter carrying proofs in her father's shop that Anthony Grafton ferreted out from a marginal annotation in his Culture of Corrections in Renaissance Europe. So my focus is on a particularly ubiquitous player in textual cultures, not only in early modern Europe, but throughout many times and places prior to the advent of the computer, the people who were the closest assistants of scholars, typically identified by their role in writing for another, whether by copying, taking dictation, or composing, among other tasks. And in this first lecture, I'd like to offer a long historical perspective by looking back to ancient and medieval terms and patterns, and then looking forward to the modern period and our own digital age. And then I'll settle into my principal focus for the rest of the lectures, which will be the 16th century, aka Northern Renaissance and Reformation. So in the first part, I'll examine the semantic field around the term I've chosen, amanuensis, which is hardly a household word today. The term at root designates a hand servant, amanu, as opposed, for example, to a footman. And the Latin is considered synonymous with the Greek pokeroforos, from pokeros, at hand, and foros, carrying. So pokeroforos occurs mostly in documentary papyri and can be used either for an important royal official or for a slave. This is a reminder that the enslaved in Greco-Roman antiquity could be educated precisely in order to perform a variety of text-based roles, reading aloud from texts written in scriptio continua, writing under dictation or by selective note-taking on wax tablets, or making a more durable copy of a text on a papyrus roll, or teaching reading and writing to children both free and unfree. And classicists are doing exciting new work in this area, among them Joseph Howley at Columbia. Suetonius is apparently the only Roman author to have used the term amanuensis, and just twice in his Lives of the 12 Caesars. In the first passage, Suetonius says of Nero that in preparing a campaign, Nero would levy from the city tribes a stated number of slaves to serve as soldiers, not even exempting the paymasters and amanuenses. So is he adding even because those in these latter two occupations were presumed to be less well suited to military activities? Secondly, Suetonius ascribed to the Emperor Titus many physical and intellectual skills, including this curious one. I have heard from many sources that Titus used also to write shorthand with great speed and would amuse himself by playful contests with his amanuenses. Also, that he could imitate any handwriting that he had ever seen and often declared he might have been the prince of forgers. So we learn that ancient amanuenses were skilled in writing fast, including in shorthand, and in multiple styles of handwriting. The other ancient occurrences of the word are administrative. For example, in the legal sententiae of the second century jurist Julius Paulus, and this excerpt seems to be corrupt and incomplete and is a bit obscure. These are few references, basically. But amanuensis surfaces regularly in English translations of ancient texts because the concept is much more widespread in Roman antiquity than the particular word itself. And this is a distinction I vividly remember from reading Neil Kenny's first book on curiosity. So Romans used other words to designate their hand servants that have been well translated into English as amanuensis. For example, one of Martial's epigrams, untitled in antiquity, acquired this one in English translation, at least by the 19th century, on the death of his amanuensis, Demetrius. In it, Martial lamented the early death of, quote, that faithful hand, illa manus fida, of my studies. And the poem reveals the deceased was enslaved while in Martial's service for 4 years at age 15 and manumitted on his deathbed. The most famous amanuensis of antiquity was Marcus Tullius Tiro, who worked for another Marcus Tullius, Cicero, from whom he received his nomen and praenomen. Tiro was likely raised as an educated slave in Cicero's household and was a constant presence in managing Cicero's letters and affairs starting in at least 54 BCE when he was first mentioned. And he played a crucial role in preserving and editing Cicero's writings after the latter's assassination in 43. Cicero refers to Tiro as scriba meus and hails him once as the canon of my writings, perhaps in the sense of model or guide, or perhaps in the meaning of severe critic. Most mentions of Tiro by other Roman authors called him Cicero's freedman. He was manumitted in 53 BCE, probably when he was in his late 20s, and continued to work for Cicero as a freedman. But Aulus Gellius introduces an additional descriptor in his Attic Nights, calling Tiro Cicero's adjutor in literis studiorum, an aid in the cultivation of his studies. A more common term is notarius, which Pliny the Younger used to describe the person at his uncle's side, poised with scroll and wax tablet in hand in order to read or take notes, as Pliny required. We don't know if this notarius was free or enslaved. Either was possible. Librarius is another frequently used term for the role, notably in an account which has had a long life as a trope of the great man. Pliny the Elder praised Julius Caesar in his Natural History for, quote, the most outstanding instance of innate mental vigor. He used to write or read and dictate or listen simultaneously, and to dictate to his librarii four letters at once on his important affairs, or if otherwise unoccupied, seven letters at once. So I'd like to follow this trope of dictating to many at once for a bit, because it involves public mention of amanuenses, which is a fairly rare occurrence, and in quite different contexts. Pliny's claim about Caesar caught the attention of Francis Bacon, who lists it as the first example in his Advancement of Learning in the chapter of Summities of Human Nature out of the Faithful Reports of History, and he thus gave it much greater circulation as a sign of the great leader. Napoleon, in particular, commissioned an image of Caesar dictating to multiple scribes for the Palazzo Quirinale in Rome, which he planned to make the seat of his empire, though he never actually inhabited it. And Napoleon was later depicted himself dictating to multiple amanuenses, in this case posthumously. Interestingly, the same ability to dictate text to more than one scribe at once was also reported of religious greats, of Thomas Aquinas and Catherine of Siena, and I'd love to hear about other cases from you. In these cases, it's the scribes themselves who reported this ability, which also, of course, was interpreted as a sign of special divine inspiration. Finally, there's a third strand of this trope, which first surfaces to my knowledge in a letter of Poliziano to Pico della Mirandola, extolling the amazing feats of intelligence and memory of one Fabio Orsini, an 11-year-old in the noble Orsini family in Rome, circa 1488. Young Fabio performed in front of Poliziano and others, first reciting verse of his own composition, then turning the verse into prose, and the display culminated in the boy dictating extemporaneously five letters on five different topics that Poliziano had selected, some of them ridiculous, Poliziano explains, so that the boy could not possibly have prepared this in advance. Five librarii were found with styluses and tablets to take down what he dictated, and the boy proceeded to dictate on the first topic to the first amanuensis, then, while that one was writing, moved on to the next, and so forth, through all five, and around, until he'd produced five different letters, quote, without anything appearing discordant or disjointed. This account was still circulating 300 years later, shorn of its humanist sources, among stories of child prodigies collected in Nathaniel Wanley's Wonders of the Little World, with printings down to 1791, along with another example of a 14-year-old Dutch boy doing the same in 1631. In the 18th century, the gentleman philosopher Abraham Tucker cited Caesar's ability as evidence that we should all cultivate such mental agility. So Pace Napoleon's view, viewing it as a sign of exceptional greatness, dictating to many at once also appeared by then as an ability that anyone could cultivate, which might not be so special after all. So this excursus into the trope of dictating to many at once offers a quick preview of some of the complexities ahead. Taking dictation is the iconic activity of the amanuensis, and it's certainly a task that amanuenses actually performed. But public mentions of amanuenses, e.g. in print or in paintings, were not focused on the amanuenses themselves or their activities, but instead designed to support some other purpose, typically to boost the reputation of the principal for whom they worked. And this emphasis is true whether the story was initiated by the principal, by a third party, like Pliny telling it of Caesar, or by the amanuenses themselves, in the case of Thomas Aquinas and Catherine of Siena. So a recurring theme of these lectures will be to examine the factors that encourage the effacement or self-effacement of amanuenses, and why and when they do surface in public media occasionally. Furthermore, the trope of dictating to many also illustrates the large range of circumstances in which people served as amanuenses. We have the five librarii, young adults at least, deployed to display the prowess of a child, a very special child for both his skills and his high social rank. But the Fabio Orsini story, with its reversal of the usual dynamic of the young in service of their elders, foreshadows other cases I'll discuss of surprising departures from what we expect. And the example of Catherine of Siena is a reminder that women are part of my study too, as they navigated the gender hierarchies of their context, whether as principals or as amanuenses. But before we venture further into examples, I'd like to spend a bit more time on the thorny problems of terminology. Just now you noticed maybe that I used the term principal to designate the person relying on the services of the amanuensis. I'm trying it as an alternative to master, which carries different connotations depending on the dyad involved, master pupil, master servant, master slave, among others. I'll be interested in your feedback about principal. I borrow the term from Harvard administrative emails addressing principals and their assistants. So a principal is anyone who relies on an assistant in the org chart. Maybe some good can be gotten of the explosion of corp speak, my institution at least, where we regularly hear from people reaching out to loop us in to some recent learnings. And I'm also responding to the broader impulse, quite strong in American academic settings at the moment, to remove words closely associated with the American practice of slavery. So principals are the scholars I'll be talking about who are relying on the help of others to speed up or to carry out their work. As for amanuensis, we can now conclude the term was actually uncommon in classical Latin, although the role was not. Romans used a cluster of other terms instead. And a couple few more I haven't mentioned yet include exceptor from excipere, for one who snatches words out of the air from speech, tabellio, tabellarius, and then various terms that referred not to the activities performed by the amanuenses, but rather to their status, Tyro, known as Cicero's libertus. They could also be called ministri, famuli, or servi. In the Middle Ages, the role existed too, and among the terms used to describe it, notarius and scriba are the predominant ones, but in addition, in the setting of religious orders, there was a new term. Aquinas's best-known assistant was Reginald, a fellow Dominican, whom he and others called Aquinas's socius, or companion. And Catherine of Siena at first dictated her letters to female scribes, but as she gained in reputation, she shifted to relying on male scribes for letters and her major work, the Dialogo. One hypothesis that historians have emitted to explain this shift, which isn't discussed in the primary sources, is that the male scribes were perceived to lend greater authority to her texts. In any case, most crucial to her success in gaining authority as a female mystic was the support of a male confessor. A confessor's approval was important to assert the divine origin of any visionary, male or female, but especially necessary for women who were presumed to be more vulnerable to being misled by false visions. Catherine worked with two confessors in succession, and the second of these, Raymond of Capua, was a leader in the Dominican order, also occasionally served as her scribe and then wrote her biography, which was very instrumental to her canonization. Catherine referred to her followers as her familia, as sons and daughters in Christ, and addressed Raymond as her very loved and dearest father in Christ. And this depiction really shows how the saint is really a vessel, a conduit for the divine message into the scribe. So she is she's just hearing and speaking rather than writing. To pursue this excursus into terminology, amanuensis, not being a classical term or a medieval term, is a term put into use by the humanists and mostly after 1500. It remained a Latin term, but also moved unchanged into vernaculars, especially German and English. The OED gives 1619 as the first occurrence in English and offers as an early example a passage in Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy. I should have revised, corrected, and amended this tract, but I had not, as I said, that happy leisure, no amanuenses or assistants. I have no such benefactors as that noble Ambrosius was to Origen, allowing him 6 or 7 amanuenses to write his dictates. I must for that cause do my business myself, and was enforced to publish it as it was first written in an extemporanean style. We can see the word is italicized along with other clearly Latin terms, so Burton may not view it as a properly English word And he offers a synonym in case the reader doesn't know it. But in any case, there are certainly later occurrences confirming that the term passed fully into English in the 17th century. But let's attend briefly to the content of the quotation while we have it. Burton's point is that he had no help from anyone, and he mentions this by way of explaining why his work was not revised and corrected as it might have been. This is a kind of humility trope designed to elicit a forgiving attitude by the reader, in other words, e captatio benevolentiae. Burton also circulates, to make that point, a nice example of what he views as the ideal working conditions. He is referring to a passage in the Ecclesiastical History of Eusebius describing how Origen, the theologian and church father, was supported by a wealthy convert, Ambrose of Alexandria. When Origen dictated, this would have been 3rd century of the Common Era, there were ready at hand 7 shorthand writers who relieved each other at fixed times and as many copyists as well as girls skilled in penmanship. So Origen dictated to many, not at once, but rather in turn, after wearing out successive exceptors. On this account, Origen's team involved a careful division of labor between those taking shorthand notes from dictation, those making and revising longhand copies, the copyist, and the girls skilled in penmanship, presumably to make beautiful presentation copies for the commissioner, Ambrose, or other grandees. It's impossible to know if Robert Burton really had no help, as he asserts. Certainly drafting, let alone making a clean copy of The Anatomy of Melancholy, would have been a huge task, and maybe he did indeed write it only once, as his apology suggests. We do know of one autographed manuscript of Burton's, of a Latin comedy he wrote for a performance in 1617. And we know of other 17th century figures who wrote long manuscripts in their own hand, Joseph Scaliger and Isaac Newton, among them, for example. The entry of amanuensis into German resembles the trajectory in English. Occurrences of amanuensis in German text starts in the early 17th century, where it's treated as a Latin word printed in Roman rather than Gothic font, but is also integrated into German dictionaries both in the early modern and modern periods. And these examples of usage here show that the term could designate a scribe, whether of an individual scholar, Martin Bucer, this is an example I'll be talking about in Lecture 5, or of a prince or other ruler, here Prince Christian of Anhalt. In French and Italian, by contrast, amanuensis did not enter the vernacular. The equivalent term instead was secretary and variants, which of course also existed in German and English. So please bear with me for one more terminological excursus. Why do I not use the term secretary? In short, because that term opens up a range of contexts I won't address. Secretary, for example, designates high-ranking offices of government, both early modern and modern, the French secrétaire du roi founded in the 14th century by Charles V, or American secretaries of state today. And far from engaging in what we would consider secretarial work, these capital S secretaries relied instead on subsecretaries, some of them with official titles and further layers of secretarial help beneath them. In his 2020 Maître et Secrétaire, Nicolas Chapira examines how small S secretaries formed part of the political power structures in early modern France, operating outside the official bureaucracy in the service of French nobles and officials of various kinds. His point is that although they never appear in the official bureaucracy, these private secretaries were crucially important to the success of their principles. And for the early modern English context, which is on any topic the best studied of any place, and in which I hardly dare to venture, we have a wonderful range of excellent studies, a few offered here that I've relied on particularly. The upshot of this reading from me is that by the mid-16th century, secretary was a career path, as English aristocrats hired well-educated men to serve in both general and specialist secretarial capacities. The chief counselors to the monarchs, like the Cecils, relied on teams of 3 or 4 men, most of them gentlemen, almost all educated at university or an inn of court, to manage their public and private affairs. The most successful of these amanuenses parlayed their experience and contacts into careers that culminated in positions in Parliament or the royal administration. And the career path of the secretary could lead to great success, but was also highly insecure. Remaining in position was dependent not only on the pleasure and continued life of the principal, but also on the latter's successful navigation of the fraught and variable political landscape. When Robert Devereux, 2nd Earl of Essex, was executed in 1601 for instigating an unsuccessful rebellion, so too was his secretary, Henry Cuff, though Cuff managed to be spared being quartered until after his death, quote, for favor's sake unto learning. Given the conception of the most intimate servants as extensions of their principal, they were easily implicated with the latter's fortunes, both in rising and in falling. So there are many parallels between the secretaries of these kinds of political players and the amanuenses and scholarly households that are my focus. These relationships combined hierarchy with personal and physical closeness. Private secretaries and amanuenses often lived in the principal's house, likely spent most of each day in his company. The financial arrangements varied widely also, and are often hard to trace. Secretaries and amanuenses typically receive room and board and some combination of regular pay and or gratifications by the principal, who might, for example, share with a favored helper a portion of a gift he'd received. They could also collect gratifications from third parties for services they'd rendered on behalf of the principal, all within view of the principal, at least in the case of honest players. Paul Dover and others have argued that the term secretary, derived from classical Latin secretarium for a secluded or secret place, emerged in the 15th century in Italian context to designate a new social reality brought about by the rise of diplomatic relations among the many polities of the Italian peninsula. Dover has studied the explosion of correspondence and other paperwork generated by the activities of diplomats who resided in foreign cities and sent back regular reports on what they learned there about cultural and political dynamics. This is a lovely depiction of everyone crowded around Ludovico Gonzaga. Secretaries made possible the mountains of paper generating letters and records to be sent and received, often ciphered to keep them secret, and then, of course, deciphered, stored, and sorted. Composing letters, in some cases only from brief instructions by the principal, was so closely associated with the role of the secretary, but the late 16th century, the term secretary also designated a kind of book, the letter-writing manual. And by the 18th century, also, a piece of furniture comprising a writing surface and drawers for composing and storing those letters. So amanuensis, on the contrary, is not as polysemous. It almost always designates a person. I do have one case of Francis Bacon using the term amanuensis as a kind of book, a guidebook. So we're dealing with a complicated semantic field, which is blurry around the edges and varies by language. If the scholarly amanuensis is the concept I'm after, the terms used in my early modern focus are many, including ones we've seen already, but a few new ones, calligraphus domesticus, or in the words of a student who served as a scribe and hoped to share the principal's table, commensalis or convictor. As this latter case suggests, some who played the role of amanuensis also held other statuses in the life of the principal, for example, as live-in students or former students, or as members of his family, wife and children most often, but others possibly too. And I will include some examples of these amanuenses plus in the lectures ahead. So I'll shift now to my second part, using a few modern examples to help us define what's distinctive about early modern. Early modern is, and I have this, is less evocative than earlier appellations such as Renaissance and Reformation, which it has replaced. But the expression helpfully contributes to the notion that early modern is a kind of modern, connecting it to later centuries, though of course the period is crucially indebted to earlier ones. And the history of amanuenses is one of long continuities into a myriad modern contexts down to quite recent times. So let's pick up the thread of the most iconic reliance on an amanuensis, composing by dictation. This was the norm in antiquity and remained a common practice in medieval and early modern times, alongside the rise of autography, or writing in one's own hand, which is first documented starting in the 13th century. But there are also many excellent examples of composing by dictation in the 19th and 20th centuries, which can illustrate a few significant social and technical changes. So this portrait of Goethe, dictating to his secretary Jon, by Johann Georg Schmeller, positions the two to match their roles in writing. Goethe fully faces the viewer-reader, while we can only get a hint of Jon's features as he has his back to us, with a slight turn reminding us that he too is an individual, but subordinated in this activity to Goethe's instructions. Jon was not a particularly significant servant among the many that Goethe employed, and whom he generally all called Karl, regardless of their given names. A real Karl, Karl Stadelmann, by contrast, was a servant most often mentioned in Goethe's Jahrbuch. Goethe was well aware of the hazards of his method of writing, and he wrote an essay on the kinds of error which could result from mishearing during dictation, misreading of handwriting, or error in typesetting. And he also faced an unexpected hazard from composing by dictation. One of his novels, Wilhelm Meister's Wanderjahre of 1829, turned out shorter than expected at the printers because Goethe had changed amanuenses midway through the composition, and the new scribe's handwriting was larger than the first one's, throwing off Goethe's estimate of the length of what he'd written. This anecdote is reported by Johann Peter Eckermann, Goethe's best-known amanuensis, who was tasked with fixing the problem by weaving in unrelated aphorisms into the ending of the novel from a pile of assorted papers that Goethe gave him, with results that have puzzled readers at the time and since. Goethe addressed the contemporary criticism for this ending by claiming that the novel was, quote, a vehicle for bringing significant things into the world. But Eckermann tells this story in his conversations with Goethe during the last 10 years of his life, published a few years after Goethe's death. And Eckermann also published, on Goethe's instruction, unlike these conversations, the latter's Nachgelassene Schriften. And this is another powerful role of the amanuensis, especially one in place at or near the time of death of the principal. The amanuensis as curator of the principal's oeuvre is the topic of my fifth lecture. Eckermann's reputation as recorder of Goethe's life became so iconic that the dissident East German songwriter Wolf Biermann composed a ballad with the punchline, "Die Stasi ist mein Eckermann." Between the late 19th and the mid-20th century, separate developments in technology and social patterns changed the default model for composition by dictation, and Henry James' behavior happens to track it nicely. He composed by dictation, first to a male stenotypist, William McAlpine, using a Remington typewriter, which James acquired in 1897. And starting in 1901, though, James employed women who operated that typewriter, Mary Weld, then Theodore Bosanquet. James commented of his male stenographer, "He's too damned expensive and always has been, and too place-taking in my life and my economy. I can get a highly competent little woman for half, or a less full-blown young man at a greater abatement." Women would always have been cheaper to hire, but by 1900, they were also highly competent. The growth of secondary education for girls was an important prerequisite, more than the typewriter itself. Delphine Gardet explains that the typewriter was not feminized initially. When Remington first marketed its typewriter in 1874, it was adopted by male clerks and secretaries, but production really took off between 1890 and 1910, precisely when office staffing started to change from predominantly male to mixed gender to predominantly female by 1940, largely for the same financial reasons that Henry James articulated. The feminization of office work applied to stenography, too, which is speedier than typing for taking dictation and more portable. We have accounts of and by the young women and one male secretary who worked for Winston Churchill. They tell of taking dictation in all kinds of situations, while riding in cars or trains, or while he was taking a bath, and she would listen from outside the bathroom door. The life of the secretary has changed dramatically, both technologically and socially. The dictaphone was trademarked in 1907, and its gradual uptake in the following decades allowed typists to operate in pools separate from the person dictating, breaking the physical proximity that until then was built into dictation. And then came the computer. In 1990, Dragon Dictate was an early speech recognition software which needed to be trained by the user and even so introduced errors, not typos or simple oral misunderstandings of one word for another, but spectacular misunderstandings in which words would be broken up or combined in surprising ways as the software tried to map a word like Aristotelianism onto its known vocabulary. And I wish I had saved some of these things that I, of course, corrected in my notes. Early years of use of word processors continued to evolve amanuenses in some cases. And outside in the display cases, we have the case of this novel by the British author Len Deighton, which is the first long-form book to be composed by a word processor. Here is the machine in his office and the way it worked with a human operating it, and an unusual photo, thanks to Matthew Kirschenbaum, of Eleanor Handley, who handled the machine. So we see here that there's a new technology, but socially it's integrated into the format of dictating to a secretary, or of the secretary handling the typewriter, as I think she's got, actually this electric typewriter is what she's working on in that photo. The way technology changed faster than social arrangements seems an excellent demonstration of a fascinating point that Jeffrey Nunberg made in 1996 about how much harder it is to imagine new social arrangements than new technology. He noted how in this 1953 image of life in the year 2000, the author anticipated too much technological change. Our couches haven't changed much, actually, in the last, whatever, 70 years. And on the contrary, not enough social change. Talking about the housewife's daily cleaning seems like something from the deep past. Even if social patterns are generally resistant to change, many factors conspired in the end to end the long tradition of relying on amanuenses. In addition to technical and cultural ones, such as the rise of personal computers and the instruction of children in their use, financial ones, of course, have been powerful. The constant drive to cut costs around employment, especially in places with high labor costs. Wendell Berry's essay explaining that he would not buy a computer because he could rely on his wife to type up his work and to be his best critic in the process, he added, has proven very long-lived on the internet, eliciting not only predictable criticism of the gender dynamics he describes, but also support for the hostility he professes against computers by posters who are, of course, posting their comments on digital platforms. So we are well aware of the many hazards of our highly digitized world, but few of us succeed in opting out of it. Barry may still acknowledge his wife for typing, but we can trace the rise and fall of that trope in acknowledgments by asking Google Ngram to search its stock of digitized books, including those still in copyright, which can only be viewed in snippets. So Wife for Typing peaks around 1975 and now has subsided back down to the low level of occurrence characteristic of the 1920s. Instead, we encounter different kinds of acknowledgments of hardware and software, usually when they're new. So back to Balmer, how do we know about his use of a computer? It's because in his acknowledgments, Dayton thanks IBM for the magnetic tape selector typewriter which he used and the tech support that helped him use it in the person of none other than Jacques Maison-Rouge, who was president of IBM at the time. So presumably composing a long book manuscript on the machine was a first, as Dayton claims, and caught the attention of the company president. Or maybe there was a personal connection between the two. I don't know. Certainly the rest of us who need regular help from IT experts to set up a computer or manage the damage caused by upgrades or rescue files from loss turn to an institution, perhaps, pay for it privately, or turn to one's tech-savvy offspring, if possible. So these are the kinds of helpers who don't often figure in acknowledgments even today, but without whom a book wouldn't get done. But there is this very interesting acknowledgment in Zadie Smith's novel, thanking the software Freedom, which blocks internet access for a chunk of time, and it still exists also. Of course, as of last December, we have chatbots that can write competent English prose from a prompt, even if the informational content is not reliable. They're filling another role that amanuenses long played. Have computers and various software programs become our amanuenses? Markus Krajewski drew attention to this implication in the two meanings of the German word Diener, which designates both a human servant and a computer server. To some extent, then, my project fits a pattern of examining what was once a widespread practice, relying on a human amanuensis, precisely after it's no longer common, and thus comes to seem interesting. The main circumstances today in which human amanuenses play a crucial role alongside hardware and software are cases of disability or illness of kinds that prevent the direct use of digital tools. The author Ved Mehta, for example, blind from a young age, wrote in 2009 about the difficulties of working in the New York Public Library with an amanuensis who needed to read aloud from the library catalog to aid him in his research, but at the time there was no good place to do that. Disability and illness motivated the use of amanuenses in the early modern period as well. Milton's worsening eyesight comes to mind. Thomas Hobbes developed a shaking palsy, probably due to Parkinson's disease, even at the age of 60, and even that composed for another 20 years through the hand of another. He relied on his baker, James Weldon, who had a clear hand but little education. So Hobbes had to hire someone else to go over the Latin and then warned the printer to take special care with it, as Noel Malcolm has detailed. Furthermore, reliance on amanuenses due to illness was considered acceptable to acknowledge explicitly in print, even in the early modern period, although it's not mentioned consistently. For example, and this is a passage in a book that's outside in the display as well, Robert Boyle mentioned a distemper in his eyes in the paratext to three works he published between 1659 and 61. In each case, he invoked this circumstance to apologize for not having so much as read over the manuscript before sending it to the printer. So in his new experiments touching the air, he offered this interesting detail. Besides all this, the distemper in my eyes forbidding me not only to write myself so much as one experiment, but even to read over myself what I had dictated to others, I cannot but fear that besides the author's mistakes, this edition may be blemished by many that may be properly imputed to a very unskillful writer whom I was oftentimes by haste reduced against my custom to employ, and may have escaped the diligence of that learned friend that doth me the favor to oversee the press, especially there being the distance of 2 days' journey betwixt it and me. So Boyle engages here in two layers of self-justification by emphasizing, first, that he's forced to rely on others for health reasons, and secondly, that due to pressures of time, he had to work with an unskilled writer against his custom. Boyle maintained a long habit of composing by dictation. Michael Hunter has identified some 13 long-serving amanuenses by their handwriting in Boyle's papers, and more than a dozen other occasional scribes. He's also observed that Boyle was uniquely prone to anxious and defensive paratextual statements like this one. But we'll also see this pattern of blaming an amanuensis for errors in other authors. And this pattern is, of course, the exact opposite of the refrain we are used to seeing in acknowledgments today, in which the author concludes a list of people thanked by taking responsibility for errors rather than pinning the blame elsewhere. Françoise Vaquet has studied the history of acknowledgments, among other trappings of our academic genres, and although articulations of thanks can be found long before, and I'll discuss some in Lecture 4, she identified the late 19th century as the time when the first acknowledgments appeared in her corpus of French academic writing. At that time, they consisted of a brief paragraph thanking academic mentors. Acknowledgments then increased in number gradually, but remained sporadic until they became standard after 1945, which is also the moment at which Vaquet noticed the first acknowledgment of a wife. If we ask Google for engram, "All errors are my own," we see a spike forming in the late 70s and still climbing. And here are a couple early examples. I thought it was interesting that in 1973, the expression is viewed as a familiar prefatory formula useful for pupils who use it when attempting to articulate a teacher's position without full success. So modern patterns of acknowledgement, here's another couple, are quite different from the early modern practices of pinning blame on amanuenses. And today, we are so often our own amanuenses that the errors of the amanuenses are indeed our own. So, I hope that the various examples I presented today from ancient Rome to the recent past form a convincing argument for long continuities in the reliance on amanuenses. I'll focus in the next lectures on the early modern period, especially the 16th century, and to outline the themes ahead, I'd like to talk a bit about the image I chose for the publicity. This depiction of a principal and an amanuensis working together is the only image I know of to have been commissioned by the amanuensis, granted almost 20 years after the end of the relationship. The caption explains it depicts on the left Gilbert Cousin of Nozeroy, amanuensis of Erasmus at age 26 in 1530, and on the right Desiderius Erasmus of Rotterdam, the great humanist at the height of his fame at age 70 in 1530, the year in which Cousin entered Erasmus's household. The computation of ages is off by modern lights. Erasmus is considered to have died at age 70 in 1536, so it would have been 64 or 65, and Cousin 24 or 25. No matter. The point is that the older, super famous scholar and the young man are working together in a remarkably egalitarian depiction. Erasmus is wearing fur, which is a sign of wealth, perhaps also of sensitivity to the cold, while Cousin is not. But both are wearing hats and sitting on chairs of the same height, though Erasmus's chair is a bit fancier. It has a cushion and a broader back. The location of the scene is likely Freiburg, where one of the houses where Erasmus lived still stands, Zum Walfisch. The other one is now a shopping passage. So after living in Basel for 15 years, Erasmus had moved to Catholic Freiburg when Basel went over to the Reformation in 1529, and Erasmus was worried about staying there. But then he returned to Basel in 1535 in a move that Cousin helped to manage. So I'm not aware of any other depiction of principal and amanuensis working together in the 16th century, but a comparand that comes to mind that might have been an inspiration for Cousin's depiction, especially with that flower in the middle. It originated in Basel, where Cousin maintained strong ties, was published in 1542, that's 10 years before the Effigies, the actual painting we're looking at. But I'd like also to show you some other depictions of amanuenses I've encountered. These come from the 17th century. This one, Der Gelehrte, was the work of Thomas Weick, who loved to satirize alchemists. He has a whole series of works called The Alchemist. And you can see some alchemical bits in this painting, too. And he's satirizing the learned man here by showing a complete mess of papers and books and a helper, circled in red, not well visible. He's not wearing a hat. He's sitting lower than the principal on a stool, whereas the principal is in a chair, an armchair, with a hat. And I think this painting helps us appreciate how different in tone Cousin's image is. I'm aware of one painting here of principal and student or amanuensis, which is also sort of favorable to both in tone. But I've not managed to find any context for it, and I'd be grateful for any suggestions of how to move forward. Maybe the clerical collar is distinctive. Given the patterns I've encountered elsewhere, I'm inclined to think that the young man here is a relative of the principal or of the person who commissioned the painting. The only other depictions of Erasmus at work are the many portraits that Erasmus commissioned of Hans Holbein. As gifts for friends and patrons, in some cases, when Erasmus was invited to visit somewhere but didn't want to go, he sent a painting instead. And Holbein kept a model on hand so he could make a portrait even in Erasmus's absence. And these depict Erasmus reading or writing or thinking in the company of some books, not books he owned, as in the portraits of ordinary educated people, but books he'd written. These portraits, of course, were idealized in order to convey a persona rather than a real person. And I think we should agree likely just as much of an idealization. According to an 18th century treatise on the region of Franche-Comté, Cousin's house in Nozeroy featured a fresco version of the same scene. So the remediation of the wall painting, now lost, into a woodcut was crucial to its transmission. It's the first two full opening illustrations in a 25-page pamphlet. So here, just to remind us of just how many Erasmus depictions there are, this pamphlet then is Cousin's counterpart, basically. And what is Cousin doing? He is celebrating a big moment in his life. In 1552, he had just published this first big book of his on the history of Burgundy. He was also running a humanist school in Nozeroy, which even attracted a few sons from Basel families who'd been associated with Erasmus, and thus he worked with them while he was in Erasmus's employ. And you can see in the Burgundy book, he has a little symbol for himself, coming inspired by Matthew. He's got a medallion portrait of himself, and these are reproduced in the pamphlet here, the Effigies pamphlet, where he reproduces his own portrait, and then the first full page opening in this pamphlet is our painting. It's followed by other good ones, like his hometown of Nozeroy, which he will reprint in his Opera Omnia of 1563, along with detail showing where his house is and his library. Very interestingly, he does not reprint his picture of himself with Erasmus. Has he decided in 1563 that he doesn't want to portray himself in that subservient position? I don't know. I'm kind of surprised. He has many poems praising Erasmus still in the Opera Omnia. So both the ability and the willingness of Cousin to depict his work as an amanuensis in print are quite unusual. And he then goes on. He's clearly preparing a further edition of this pamphlet, because the copy at the University of Basel contains the printed version larded with manuscript annotations and things even from print tipped in. These are further poems, poems of praise of Erasmus, poem of praise of learning, poems in praise of Cousin, which presumably he's collected in order to make a second edition of this pamphlet, which of course never happens. So, the road ahead. Obviously, Cousin has given us this beautiful depiction, very unusual, of him at work with Erasmus. When are amanuenses visible and when are they invisible? I will be talking about the many factors that conspire to minimize the visibility of amanuenses, but I'm also going to argue that they're more visible in the 16th century than in prior periods, and in particular because they're mentioned in print in order to serve a variety of rhetorical purposes that I bundle together as the servant function. What is the function of the servant in a book? Why do you talk about them? And basically, just take the blame for errors is certainly one big purpose of the servant function. Next Tuesday in Lecture 3, I'll focus on the kinds of works that amanuenses performed. Cousin's image represents the iconic activity of taking dictation, which of course is a two-person activity. Cousin is also positioned near the open bookcases in this image, and perhaps that symbolizes the fact that he was managing Erasmus's books, that he would go fetch books, and certainly amanuenses were responsible for people's libraries, for buying books, for ordering, arranging them and finding things in them and so forth. More generally, amanuenses often did work that the principal could have done himself and delegated in order to save time or because of illness, as we've seen. But they could also contribute skills that the principal lacked, such as being able to write legibly or beautifully or knowing unusual languages or how to draw or to make mathematical tables. And I'll argue that even tasks that we consider, or the principals considered mechanical, and this term was used at the time largely as a pejorative, always also required a fully intellectual engagement from those who performed them. So the third lecture is about the difference in perspective between principal and amanuensis. In the fourth lecture, I'll ponder the attributions of texts and paratexts in light of cases in which what's presented in print at the time was unreliable. In some cases, amanuenses were deprived of credit, but I've also found cases of the reverse, where they were given undue credit, and we can talk about why that might be. And in the last lecture, I'll emphasize the role that amanuenses played in shaping the legacy of their principals. Erasmus's legacy was so massive that Cousin was only a bit player in that transmission. But by outliving Erasmus and seeking to commemorate him from his unusual perspective, Cousin contributes a novel depiction of the great man that blends expressions of loyalty with a strong sense of Cousin's own achievements. So, many thanks for being here today, and I look forward to the lectures ahead. And I even ended early. Oh, amazing.